News feeds have been filled with images of the impacts of hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Scientists continue to warn about extreme weather trends related to the burning of fossil fuels, trends in which storms increase in strength and frequency as water and air temperatures rise. How will the capital region and neighborhoods like North Central Troy be impacted by severe weather in the future? Dr. Stephen Lebo, professor of modern international history and politics at the Sage Colleges, was personally trained by former Vice President Al Gore to serve as the Climate Reality Project's New York coordinator. He sat down with Megan Marone to discuss the future of upstate New York's earth, water, air, and people.
Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Lebo. In your estimation, how is climate change likely to affect the capital region in the years and decades to come? And what do you see as the most likely effects on the environment, the economy, politics, and physical infrastructure here?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm really pleased to be here. What you guys are doing here is really important. But here's the core issue. Climate change is a global phenomenon, but of course it plays out differently. It plays out differently in Bangladesh than it does in Mongolia, for example. And here, with the capital region in upstate New York, we're dealing with two different things. We are impacted by the same rising temperatures, invasive species coming along, those kinds of things. This strange situation where more often than not we have less snow, but occasionally, like Boston just recently, massively more. But then there's the other issue that plays out much more obviously, is how does it play out locally and regionally? And we have a couple of complicated situations going on. The simple fact of the matter is that there are other regions that are in greater danger. The massive percentage of Americans that live along the coast or in the Northeast coast, that huge corridor around New York City and New Jersey. As climate change becomes more dramatic, and perhaps even more importantly earlier on, as people begin to understand the threat of living along the coasts, they are going to be making different kinds of decisions about relocating. And, of course, in the 21st century, it doesn't matter so much that you live in a particular place. So we are in an area which is somewhat safer. So as large numbers of people move in from the coast and move up from the southern part of the United States, all areas that are in greater danger than we are, we have to plan separately for, frankly, an intrusion of far more people moving to this area. How does that play out for a young person like yourself? The issue is, how does that play out with all of those people, particularly those that move early, and take equity for more expensive places along the coast and move up to upstate New York? So we have to begin, and one of the most core issues is that places like Albany, for example, I believe, are going to become much larger. The same kind of thing, this incredible natural resource of, we have of the Adirondacks in that sense. So places like the Adirondacks are, in one sense, much hurt by, they have an economy that is deeply tied up, for example, with winter sports. As winter sports diminish, at the same time, they are going to be seen as much more valuable as areas for real estate relocation. So we have to think through, how does climate change play out in a larger area, the same problems other people have, but we are one of those areas we can think of as a climate refugee destination. And that itself requires a thinking through how we want to deal with the 21st century challenges.
Given that it seems unlikely that the federal government is going to take much substantial action on climate change for the next few years, what role do you see for local grassroots movements in fighting climate change? And how important are these movements in your estimation? What can they do? And what should we expect from grassroots movements?
Well, here's the great irony of what's been going on. The reason we have the new administration, at the federal level, of course, we have Donald Trump and a large number of people who, for one reason or another, are in denial about climate change or pretending they are for financial reasons. And that is what federalism put us in this situation. But on the other hand, federalism through the Electoral College may have created the Donald Trump presidency. But America, one of its great strengths is the very diversity, the decentralized nature of America. So I believe that if you get the states and a coalition, a climate coalition of states, which has already begun to emerge from, for example, Washington State and California to New York, we can create a opposite narrative, if you will, on a local level within the United States, but also on a global level, a coalition of American states that can challenge, shall we say, the narrative that is emerging in this case about America's desire under the Trump administration to pull out of the Paris Accords. So I think it is terribly, terribly important that recognizing the irony that the federalism got us in this situation, federalism can help get us out. And here in this particular area, in the capital region, it's particularly important because we're not just a local area. We are in a position to impact the state government of one of the most influential states in the United States. So everything we can do to get the Cuomo administration to work particularly well with Jerry Brown's administration in California, Governor Inslee's in Washington State, and all of those others, we have a profoundly important role to play. And then there's the opposite issue. It's not just about mitigating, reducing the amount of carbon, you know, climate-busting carbon and fossil fuel emissions in the atmosphere. We have to adapt. Adaptation happens at the local level because the fact is we waited too long. So we in the capital region need to think through what are we going to do when you have the Hudson River or the Mohawk expanding far more regularly? What are we going to do as our economies diminish? Because, for example, we have a lot of apple farms in the upstate area. Well, you have a beautiful, wonderful, warm spring-like day in the middle of February, and you have had a devastating impacts on, for example, the apple orchards. So we have to think through, how is this going to play out? What adjustments are we going to make? And recognizing that other issue always with us, that we are a safer area and we're going to have to deal with a lot of climate refugees moving here.
Given that local grassroots movements have also been about addressing not only issues of climate change, but usually it takes grassroots movements to address issues of race, gender, class, generally social justice issues. How do you see climate change as being connected to other social movements like addressing racism, classism?
Well, the bottom line is that the stresses that a changing climate causes, let's just take an obvious thing, rising temperatures. Now, if you have more money, you can pay for the air conditioning, pay for the equipment, and pay for the higher bill. If you live in a poor area and can't afford the air conditioning or you are forced to leave your window open, you're in a situation where, quite frankly, you are going to be more vulnerable to rising heat than someone who has more money. We are all phenomenal. We are all in this, the rich and the poor. But the fact of the matter is, wealthier people can insulate themselves somewhat more. So these are directly tied up. There's a wonderful documentary about a massive heat wave recently in Chicago. And literally, if you know Chicago from the northern suburbs, going to the southern part, depending on what block you lived in socioeconomically, you could see where more people died or less people died. So in the long run, we are all in this. But the simple fact is that in the short run, money, as is often the case, insulates people. And that plays out very dramatically. On a more immediate issue, are we going to put in place cooling stations? You're going to have a lot of people, older seniors, who cannot afford to keep their apartment comfortable. So they have to have a place to go to hang around when we are in these longer duration experiences of higher heat. That's a common element.
Now, you used the word adaptation before, and so I think I can predict your answer to this question, but in looking at the future, do you believe that the addressing of climate change will be about adapting to the effects of climate change or combating climate change increases in, you know, global heat, temperature rise?
Well, there's two different issues here. The first issue is it has to be absolutely both. If climate change meant that people in upstate New York had to get used to living in a climate that was like, I don't know, southern Georgia, we can do that. Humans are incredibly adaptable. But climate change is not switching from one climate to another. Easy to adapt, different structures of architecture. But we are going into an open circumstance of a destabilized climate that can get bigger and more dramatic. We could adapt to water rising 5 feet. We just move our water treatment terms. But we can't adapt constantly water rising 5 feet and then 10 feet and then 15 and 20. So what we need to do is mitigate the core issue, do everything we can to stop the burning of climate-busting fossil fuels. But on the same time, we have to be adapting dramatically and recognizing there are limitations to our adaption. That massive number of people in Florida might be able to handle a devastating flood once in maybe in their lifetime, perhaps once or two if the insurance industry survives. But when these things happen all the time, people do not have the resources. And insurance companies, which are totally built, much as Vegas is, on the assumption that more people pay in than they have to pay out. When the math changes on insurance, when the math changes on a mortgage of 30 years, it breaks down this one core fundamental piece of modern developed society. We try to insulate ourselves from some of the risks of life. When a bank cannot assume that that house will be around in 30 years, when an insurance company cannot assume that the vast majority of the people they insure will not have a claim, then we are moving into a completely different kind of arena.
Sounds like a different economy in some ways, too.
And much more phenomenally fragile.
In your view, we are broadcasting here from WOOC. So what do you see for local alternative community-based media in raising awareness about climate change, your points about adaptation, the way that class issues and different social issues are going to be mixed up in climate change? So, for instance, in Troy, we have the Sanctuary for Independent Media, WRPI Troy, WOOC. How do you envision the role for these types of organizations in the climate battle?
Well, I think the most obvious thing is to reinforce and promote the issues of both adaptation and mitigation on the local level. Which areas of Troy are more vulnerable than less? Here's an obvious issue. Most people know much of Troy is in a flood zone, but that's a flood zone of the last century. We need to have highlighting what is the topography of Troy. As water is likely to rise, which areas are now in the new flood zones? People have to be able to know this kind of thing. It's incredibly important. And at the same time, we have an infrastructure along to this sort of the wall along the river to try and keep Troy from flooding. Well, that is not even capable of handling flooding of the last century. That kind of thing, that level of vulnerability and activism is incredibly important. One of the things that people around here need to be really proud of is that like the Citizens Climate Lobby played a very big role in getting the former congressman, a Republican, Chris Gibson, to begin to organize this coalition, broad bipartisan congressional coalition of people who wanted to take on climate change. They accomplished that, and that has been growing very dramatically even as he's left office. So that really shows how local activists can be very, very effective. At this particular moment, and we're still within the hours, we have just had this massive, devastating experience with both what happened at Harvey in Houston and Florida. Now, one could look at those things and say they are examples of extreme weather, and that will happen from a norm from time to time, and then start planning to, I don't know, improve building codes or drainage systems in Florida. Or we can fight to make sure that that is connected, an example of the extreme weather we expect from a changing climate. And that begins to change the entire way people think and what they're going to do about or draw from the conclusions of Harvey and Irma.
Shifting topics a bit, Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now! Has just published a book arguing that American cities are at the center of a new wave of progressive action and reform around the country, a trend that stands in stark contrast to a lot of what we're seeing at the state and the federal levels. In the book, he uses Bill de Blasio of New York City as a major example, but he also talks about many smaller scale cities around the country who have elected progressive mayors and city councils. Like in Seattle, for example, with one of the first socialist city council members elected, and that these mayors and city councils are pursuing progressive policies. Do you think there's a change of jumping on the bandwagon here in the capital region and connecting progressive urban politics to climate change resistance?
Well, I personally think, and I wouldn't even start with de Blasio, that you had people like Bloomberg. One of the really interesting things about living in New York or, for example, living in California was that people from Jerry Brown to Arnold Schwarzenegger or Pataki and Cuomo, climate change did not for various reasons, become politicized. It did not become the issue to be rejected or embraced by the left or the right. And that has been terribly, terribly important. Bloomberg is a particular good example. And of course, cities where you have seen this happening. Cities are at the, you know, states don't flood. It's usually, it might be a lot of different parts of a state, but it's really the urban areas that often are most active. What we're seeing right now, for example, is a Republican mayor of Miami who has been particularly involved in this. So I think those things are terribly important because that's really the cutting edge. But on the question of what I was talking about before, it is going to be cities in the capital region who are going to have to think through what happens when large numbers of people come up and want to purchase land, who are coming up with far more money because they're selling, if they do it early enough, equity out of places like, you know, along the coast in New York City. And how are we going to deal with a circumstance where locals increasingly perhaps won't even be able to afford a home in the area their family has lived in forever? That's a really big issue, and we're seeing it in different places.
Yeah, combined with the dualistic idea, too, of not just patching up infrastructure in the ways that we've done before. So shifting to a more global geopolitical scale, can you comment on the emergence of China as a leading nation in climate change resistance? Obviously, you're also an expert on issues with China, particularly China's taking over this role in terms of having leadership in solar and wind energy.
Well, there's really two different issues. On one hand, the Chinese for a long time felt with absolute correctness, and that was understood as it emerged out of the Rio talks in 1992, that climate change has been something, a product of the developing countries burning fossil fuels for a century and a half, two centuries. And it was something that the developed Western countries should deal with while places like China or India were developing along the path. And they said, well, we'll clean up the mess later on. What you saw, though, more recently was the Chinese government recognizing that, one, number one, it doesn't matter if it's an issue of who started it, who caused it. We are all in this. But the Chinese government has also, for two different reasons, come to the realization, and this is very, very difficult for us, easy for Europeans or people who were in former communist states to recognize, that it is reasonable and appropriate for government to play a role in the economy. Now, that's a problem with climate change in the politics of America, because climate change is so enormous, so existential, and building so quickly. Only governments have the regulatory and legislative power to take on climate change and to create a kind of momentum of market forces and things of that sort. In the sort of social democratic kinds of environments you see in Western Europe, even among the most conservative, or in places like China, that's reasonable. It's a reasonable thing that the government should have some role in the economy. But in America, about half the country thinks that the government should have no role whatsoever in the economy. So there's an ideological issue. And then what we have right now is the contemporary economy speaks. We have this people like the Trump administration trying to revive the coal industry. It's a little bit like trying to push money into the horse industry as the automobiles were being developed. But what you have in China, because there is that larger vision, is a recognition that, yes, jobs are terribly important, but we want the jobs of the 21st century. So after considerable, and I've been lecturing in China for years on this, is the Chinese government began to recognize that not only is this a threat, that they had to take it on and couldn't say, oh, well, you guys caused it, but more importantly, these are the jobs of the 21st century. The Chinese just announced just recently that they're going to start phasing out all fossil fuel automobiles and pushing solar electrical vehicles. It's right across the board, because here again, ideologically, they don't have a problem with the government playing a role. They're not communist anymore. They don't think that somehow by definition the government will mess up if they're in the economy. And they're in a position to push the country in a direction that can turn China, as it was in the 20th century, a manufacturing center of the goods of the 20th century. They want to turn China into a manufacturing center of the goods of the 21st century. What the Trump administration is doing to us, we're still all in this issue of climate change. But what they are doing to Americans is they are denying us the likelihood of being able to win the jobs and in the earnings, the profits from the 21st century green energy jobs. And because of their mindset, we are not going to have the resources to develop those adaptation things, which also changing infrastructure and things like that. So we are
losing some of the advantages of consciously recognizing what is going on, protecting ourselves better and making the money, because there's going to be a lot of people out there that are going to be buying the products of the 21st century, and it'll be from places other than the United States.
Interesting. I know at RPI, they're researching how to make solar-powered cell phone batteries and things like that.
Et cetera, yeah.
In your opinion, what are the most important things that individual people here in Troy, in the Capital Region, can do right now if they're concerned about climate change?
I think we have to be quite realistic. We waited too long. And while in another time period, the focus might have been on mitigation and things like that, reducing, you know, climate-busting fossil fuels, we have to do everything we can individually. But we also have to recognize we have responsibilities to ourselves or responsibilities to our family. So I think at the same time that we begin to plan, is this the time to decide that you're going to retire to Florida or buy land in Florida? If Irma was the occasional extreme thing, or if it's part of something future, there's all the, are you going to buy that piece of land or that piece of land? We have to think through for ourselves what is best for ourselves in a changing environment. And at the same time, because here again, this is the core issue, only governments really have the power, because of the regulatory legislative power, to make the kinds of changes. So we have to do everything we can to support all of those decision makers, whether they're Democrat or Republican, it really doesn't matter, that get it. There are plenty of Republicans, if that's your inclination, that understand the challenge of climate change. And so you have to be as politically active as possible, and you have to be as personally responsible, and that adaptation for your own future and your family's future is every bit as important, because we waited too long.
Thank you so much for being in the studio with us at WOOC. Thanks, Dr. Lebo.
Well, it was delightful to be here.
That was Dr. Stephen Lebo, Professor of Modern International History and Politics at the Sage Colleges. For more information on how to engage in collective action on climate issues, go to https://citizensclimatelobby.org or visit the Climate Reality Project at www.climaterealityproject.org.